Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about olive leaf extract and how there's a lot of evidence now that it can turn off inflammation if you have heart problems. People ask about inulin, I-N-U-L-I-N. I'll talk about it. Also, a study shows severe asthmatics, well, you're not getting help from mainstream treatment. University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health, then what's it doing for you? How about nothing? What can help you? I'll share. Osteoporosis linked with heart disease in older people, so the two go hand in hand. And aspirin alternatives. Yesterday I was asked about, what do you do if you have been taking an aspirin? A person on the street asked me that, who listened to the show, and I said, I'll address it today, so I will. And a lot more on health and healing. Then, welcome to an extreme warming world. David Suzuki, we're going to talk about what it means when all this heat's going on. And by the way, each day at 4 o'clock in the morning, that's when I start my posting, I post up where the weather is extreme or exceptional, meaning so remarkable that it's the worst in history, at least that we've been recording. And we'll see that just today we had 15 events this morning alone, more cyclones in the Pacific than ever before at one time and earlier than before. And the Arctic is really hot. People thought I was joking when I said that Alaska was actually hotter than Florida for 2 days. True, but it gets worse, and I'll talk about that. Also today, we hear people talking about the war on drugs. Okay, well, I believe we shouldn't have a war on any of these things because we don't win them, and we cause enormous amount of friendly fire and casualties. But with the war on drugs, when was the last time you heard Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly, two of the big cheerleaders of the military-industrial complex and all of our great bureaucracies say, are we responsible for making sure all this heroin gets in the United States? Yeah, we are. And Mike Stobe talks about this. Number of U.S. heroin users rose 300,000. Why aren't we talking about why are people using it and how we're a main supplier of it out of Afghanistan? Also, aluminum in your body and what it means to your health. Dr. Christopher Shaw, a neuroscientist at the University of British Columbia, will share with us some really important insights into the neurotoxicity of aluminum and its association with ALS, Parkinson's, dementia, Alzheimer's. And then, where do we get this aluminum? You get more aluminum from vaccines than any place else in one jolt to the body. So these aluminum adjuvants are found in many vaccines, including Gardasil. Also today, my guest in the second part of our program, interesting, he is going to talk about Greece. He is a professor. He is Professor Mahdi Darius Nazimoroa Zaya. He is an award-winning scholar, author, geopolitical analyst, and we're going to talk about the consequences of U.S. military and economic actions in Libya and Syria. Also, you'll hear some additional play today. There was a very clever, and you won't be able to see it, so I'll just describe it in advance. There was a young college guy who had a big board out in front of the White House, and on the board, whiteboard, he put photographs of what he called, you know, the campaign cribs, the homes of these very wealthy politicians. And as college students were walking by, he would stop and say, which political candidate running for president lives in these different houses? Had a whole bunch of houses. $16 million, $13 million, $14 million. These are very expensive homes. And you'll be surprised by the answers. We'll get to that. Also, one person stood up and on this issue, not on all, but on this issue, told the truth to the European Parliament yesterday. Not a word about this in the United States. Now, actually, he told it today. They're behind us there. And I will play that for you because, boy, the whole world needs to hear this. If time permits today, Dr. Peter Rost, influencing the medical establishment, and he is a former vice president of Pfizer and a whistleblower of the pharmaceutical industry. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. I believe that people should have olive leaf extract, 1,000 milligram tablets, in their home if they get an infection. It's great if you have the flu or a cold or feel one coming on to take 1,000, 2,000 milligrams a couple times a day. If you travel, it's one of the must-take elements. You put in a little package and take them with them. Olive leaf extract is extraordinarily positive. But there's something we didn't know it does, and this is from the University of Reading in the United Kingdom. And here's what it has to say. I'll quote verbatim. Supplementation with olive leaf extract could improve vascular function and reduce inflammatory cytokines linked to heart disease, according to new human trial data. The randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled crossover trial investigated the absorption and metabolism of polyphenols from olive leaf extract, in addition to measuring the physiological outcomes, quote, in order to build a greater understanding of the cause and effect relationship between olive leaf extract intake and potential biological effects. Led by research from the University of Reading and backed by funding and research from New Zealand government, the study is said to provide, quote, the first evidence that olive leaf extract positively modulates vascular function and the interleukinate production in vivo, adding to growing evidence that olive phenolics could be beneficial for health. This was published in the British Journal of Nutrition. Now, in lay language, what does this mean? This is one more piece to that massive puzzle that keeps growing, that the individuals consuming a Mediterranean diet rich in olives and olive oil, but also if you travel the country, not in the cities, but if you go into the countryside in Spain, Greece, Italy, and less so in France, you'll find that they take the olive leaf, crush it up, and put it into different poultices to be applied or into syrups to be consumed, but they're very aware and have been for thousands of years that the olive leaf is important. So now we have this evidence, and why I mentioned that it was a double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized crossover trial with humans is because that is the ultimate gold standard in science. Does it work? You bet. Will it help you turn off inflammation? Yes. Will it help you lower your heart markers like C-reactive protein, homocysteine, fibrinogen? Yes. Will that put you out of harm's way, lessening your likelihood of a heart attack or stroke? Yes. Will it help you have better capacity to breathe? Yes. So that's important. That's a lifesaver. Now, I was making a health drink recently, and I decided to share it because all these people got to looking at me when I was making it. And I make myself 2 32-ounce juices a day. And one of them is made from berries, where I'll put blueberry, whatever berries are in season, always organic. And that particular day, yesterday, I had blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, blackberries, cherries, and pomegranates. They all went in, and I put them in a blender. Don't juice them. You won't get much juice out of them. Put them in a blender. And then to that, I added some coconut oil and flaxseed oil and some rice milk, and I blended it up. And they're looking at this, and I took a little drink, And it was funny just looking at him like, can we have some? I said, sure. So I gave them all a cup, and like six, seven people. I had to make more, and they really liked it. And one of them said, what's in all this? And I said, well, first you have a lot of fibers. And also I threw some soluble fiber in there. And so they said, well, what's that? And I said, well, you're also getting what is called inulin, I-N-U-L-I-N. What to do? And why wouldn't you juice it? Well, you should do both. When you juice, you're not getting the fiber, but you're getting more of what was in the fiber, because blending does not pulverize the lignocellulose to allow the oils and polyphenols, antioxidants, and other phytonutrients out in adequate amounts. When you juice it, you get 100%, but you don't get the fiber. So why not start the day with a smoothie, and then your next drink later in the day you have as a juice? That way you get both. And I said, you need that fiber, but you need different types of fiber. Why? Because it helps with your stomach and digestion, and hence inulin is absolutely essential. It's water-soluble, dietary fiber, and it's great. It's great for you because it's also a prebiotic. And that is really good if you have any form of inflammation in the intestine. If you have ulcers, it's good. If you have itises, ileitis, colitis, spastic colon, diverticulitis, it's great. If you have constipation, helps that as well. And what happens is the dietary fiber does not get broken down in the stomach and the stomach acid. Instead, it moves slowly into your small intestine. And it mixes and it ferments, mixes with the water, ferments, and hence in that fermented stage, you're getting the very powerful, life-enhancing, absolutely necessary probiotic bacteria that comes when you get to the large intestine. And that bacteria is crucial because it can help kill some of the candida in there. And the inulin, which is so important, can help reduce cholesterol, lower your blood sugar. I recommend it for all people who are diabetic and pre-diabetic. And there are good studies on that, and it keeps you regular. So for the best outcomes, you want to get quality fibers like inulin to keep your gut bacteria fresh and healthy. And I would say 15 grams a day. If you had chicory root, that is terrific. But all of your grains break down, your whole grains break down, that's good. And Jerusalem artichoke, asparagus, bananas, garlic, dandelion root, onions, leeks, jicama, they're all good sources of inulin. So they not only enjoyed the taste, now they're going to have healthier digestion. We have millions of people suffering from asthma and some very severe asthma. This is from the University of Pittsburgh School of Health. Quote, the immune response that occurs in patients with severe asthma is markedly different from what occurs in milder forms of the lung condition. According to the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, those unique features could point the way to new treatments. This was published in the Journal of Clinical Investigations. And then it talks about what happens. Well, we know what happens with severe asthma, in which your airways become inflamed and constrict. They constrict the breathing. And then people end up with these foolish corticosteroids, and that's the mainstay treatment for typical asthma. Quote, about 10% of asthma patients have a severe form of the disease, but they account for up to half of asthma costs in the United States. That's because these patients frequently need to go to the emergency room or be hospitalized, and that's because their treatment's not working. So here are my suggestions. First and foremost, understand that a lot of asthma is due to the side effects of the adjuvants that have been used in vaccines. So go through a four-week program of daily chelation therapy. If you can afford to go to a doctor and have chelation therapy done supervised medically, good. If you can't afford that, you can do your own home form of chelation therapy using green juices, mainly chlorophylls, and your best sources of chelation would be vitamin C taken with the juice, and in the juice is chlorella and spirulina. That's your best chelation. And if you did that twice a day, you could get a lot of these byproducts that shouldn't be in your system out, plus heavy metals. Then stay away from anything known to provoke asthmatic reactions, because frequently asthma could be disguising behind allergic reaction. And when you take people off all things that are known to be proven allergens, like all wheat and dairy and yeast and sugars, then you see an enormous improvement. But allergies are tricky. They can be disguised. For example, I remember one day I received a call from the manager of a very famous musician who said, "We've tried everything, nothing works, and if we don't get some help, this person's going to ruin their career." Why? Well, the person's normal until they perform. They get up on stage, then they go bazonko and do and say things that are going to really hurt their reputation. What's the doctor say? They think it's psychological, that the person needs psychiatric treatment. So I took a little time with the person, and I asked him, "Is there anything that's different between when you're on stage and when you're off?" "No." "And so you're not afraid of performing?" "No, I love performing." "Well, there has to be something that's happening in your body." "Not a thing. I don't eat or do anything differently. I just have, you know, some milk to calm my stomach because I got a stomach problem, but that's it." Milk. Did a simple cocoa pulse test, and lo and behold, he was allergic to dairy. And guess where the allergy manifested? In the brain. And when he had a brain reaction, it manifested as kind of a psychosis. Took him off the dairy, never had a problem again. So you can have allergies manifest in weakness, fatigue, in dizziness, loss of balance, in emotional problems, including depression. I've seen people, when you clean up their diet, their depression and anxiety are alleviated also. So I believe that a lot of our asthma is due to vaccines and a processed diet filled with allergens. Clean that up and you help a person. Also, you can take now, there's a lot of really quality cytokine anti-inflammatory nutrients. Go into a health food store, any health food, and say, "Do you have something that will suppress cytokine activity, that will modulate histamine activity?" Yeah, they have them, including quercetin. That helps as well. And finally, there's two things. University of Southampton, United Kingdom, found that there's a link between coronary heart disease and osteoporosis, and both conditions could have similar causes. In one of the first studies of its kind to use special scanning technique, researchers found that people with a history of heart disease had subsequently lower cortical volume bone mineral density, and then people with osteoporosis then end up with higher heart disease. This was published in Osteoporosis International. So what is the solution here? Remineralization. Stay away from dairy because it can chelate out minerals, and take a daily supplement. The supplement should be calcium and magnesium in equal quantities, 800 to 1200 milligrams from citrate, 5 milligrams of boron, 5 milligrams of manganese, 200 milligrams of phosphorus, silica, 10 milligrams, and genistein, 100 milligrams, with quercetin, vitamin K3, 2 milligrams, and vitamin D, 3,000 units. That is as good as it gets for remineralization of your bones, and it's also heart-friendly. Take your vitamin E, coenzyme Q10, vitamin C, hawthorn, and L-carnitine, and you're protecting your heart and remineralizing your bones. A solution that takes us a step closer to understanding how these come together and how we can separate them and work with both of them simultaneously. And finally, from GreenMed Info, an aspirin alternative. I remember going for my annual checkup, which I have to do every year, and I get every test there is, including cardiovascular stress test. And for that, I have to go to a cardiologist. And I'm talking to this cardiologist, and I say, what is the most recommended prescription? He said, I recommend aspirin. I said, you realize aspirin will keep your blood thin, but it also elevates your homocysteine level and C-reactive protein level, which means you end up lessening strokes and increase heart attacks. So this is not a negative-sum gain. You end up killing people. He said, well, that's what I have to do. I said, but would you do that? He said, no. I said, what would you do? He said, well, I take my every day, and he opened up a drawer, and there he had it right in his drawer. He had coenzyme Q10, not taking enough, but he was taking 100 milligrams. Vitamin E, he was taking 200 units. He should have been at 800 with mixed tocopherols. And vitamin C, he was at 500 milligrams, should have been 5,000 milligrams. And L-carnitine, he should have been 2,000 milligrams, he was 500. But he was taking these things himself, but it wasn't recommended to his patients. Not unusual. I said, well, you're missing one. What's that? Pycnogenol. Pycnogenol? How's that work? Well, simple. Pycnogenol, P-Y-C-N-O-G-E-N-O-L, is more powerful and completely safe, safer than an aspirin. And so what happens is it keeps the platelets from aggregation. And where someone may have to take a 500 milligram aspirin, which I would absolutely be opposed to, or the lower range, what they call micro aspirins or baby aspirins, you could take 200 milligrams of pycnogenol and get the same impact, but you wouldn't have any bleeding that you would have with taking the aspirin. It does everything that the aspirin does, but does it better, and it's more natural. Now, that's only one thing to do, but at least it's better than the people who think they're doing something good by taking their aspirin, not realizing the aspirin is destroying vitamin C, folic acid, B12, and B6, which you need in order to keep a lowered homocysteine level. You increase your homocysteine, you increase your rate of heart attacks. And pycnogenol is the bark extract, and it's loaded with proanthocyanidins, a class of polyphenols found in a wide variety of plants, many of which have been in the human diet since the inception of our species. So, good way to help protect your heart. So that's it for the health and nutrition, saving lives, preventing disease, living longer. Now from our environmental segment, this is by Professor David Suzuki, and he said the following, quote, this is short but I think relevant. My hometown, Vancouver, is in a rainforest, so we celebrate sunny days. People I talk to are enjoying the recent warm, dry weather, but they invariably add, this isn't normal, especially with all the smoke from nearby forest fires. With no mountain snowpack and almost no spring rain, rivers, creeks, and reservoirs are at levels typically not seen until fall. Parks are brown. Blueberries, strawberries, and other crops have arrived weeks earlier than usual. Wildfires are burning here and throughout Western Canada. Meanwhile, normally dry Kamloops has been seeing record flooding, as has Toronto. Manitoba has been hit with several tornadoes and golf ball-sized hail. Unusual weather is everywhere. California is in its fourth year of severe drought. Temperatures in Spain, Portugal, India, and Pakistan have reached record levels, sparking wildfires and causing thousands of deaths and heat-related ailments. Heavy rains, flooding, and an unusually high number of tornadoes have caused extensive damage and loss of life in Texas, Oklahoma, and Mexico. The likely causes are complex. A stuck jet stream, the Pacific El Nino, natural variation, and climate change. Even though it's difficult to link all events directly to global warming, climate scientists have warned for years that we can expect these kinds of extremes to continue and worsen as the world warms. Some hypothesize that the strange behaviors of this year's jet stream and El Nino are related to climate change, with shrinking Arctic sea ice affecting the former. Several recent studies indicate a clear connection between increasing extreme weather and climate change. One by climatologists at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado. They looked at rising global atmospheric and sea surface temperatures, which have increased water vapor in the atmosphere by about 5%. And according to the paper published in Nature Climate Change, quote, this has fueled large storms, and in the case of hurricanes and typhoons, ones that ride atop oceans that are 19 centimeters higher than they were in the early 1900s. That sea level rise increases the height of waves and tidal surges as storms make landfall. Finally, the Stanford University study found, quote, accumulation of heat in the atmosphere can account for much of the increase in extreme high temperatures, as well as an average decrease in cold extremes across parts of North America, Europe, and Asia. Put it all together, and we're in for a big beatdown. So for those who didn't consider it important, my suggestion is look for places that are sustainable. Look for places that are not in a drought area or that will be impacted by extreme water shortages and that it's not in a tornado alley or in a hurricane area. There are many such good places to live in the United States. You can read the article on best places to live that I update regularly, and it's on the progressiveradionetwork.com, and it's an article, it's a long article, but it shows you the best places to live and why. Because a lot of places you live in now, you're not going to be able to in the future. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, broadcasting from our studios in New York City. Now we're going to do two short pieces. One is with a Dr. Chris Shaw talking about aluminum in the body and what it really means. And he's one of the leading neuroscientists, and he's an expert on aluminum from the University of British Columbia.
Well, aluminum is a really, really wonderful element. And when it was first put into an industrial application, people were really amazed with what it can do. It is very strong. It is very durable. It is very light. It is corrosion resistant. It's a good resistant. It's a good conductor of electricity. It's great stuff to build airplanes out of. It's great stuff to build cars out of. It's great stuff to make various things in your household out of. It's not a great thing to have in your body. And the reason for that is that aluminum has been selected out during the evolution of life on this planet, according to Chris Exley, who's probably the world's leading authority on aluminum in aluminum biochemistry. And what basically seems to have happened, aluminum was not bioavailable traditionally in the world's biota until really in the Industrial Revolution. And so it just had no place in any biochemical reaction that was normal. And where it does occur now, because it's increasing, we are increasingly surrounded by it. We live in what's called the age of aluminum, by at least that's Chris Exley's term. It shows up in so many products. Again, it's great stuff to make airplanes and computers out of, but it shows up in our food. It shows up in our water. It shows up in our air. It shows up in our medicines, including vaccines. It shows up in our antacids and various things that we take into our bodies. So we increasingly have this compound that is not part of any normal biochemical process on Earth for anything that now can only go in and do havoc, which is exactly what it does. It causes all kinds of unusual reactions, biochemical reactions, in the body, including in the brain. And it's been linked to Alzheimer's disease. Lucia had a very, very good article about that that came out about a year ago. It's been now linked by us to autism. There's speculations about aluminum in Lou Gehrig's disease and Parkinson's. They're not proven by any means, but they're beginning to be looked at. Aluminum has been associated with all kinds of brain disorders. And there's some evidence that aluminum may contribute to breast cancers through antiperspirants and things of that nature. So it's something you really don't want in your body. In fact, biological organisms of all kinds spend enormous energy getting it out. One of the arguments with the vaccine industry is that you eat more aluminum per day in your food than you will possibly inject. And that's true. But you have a different mechanism for excreting it. You basically excrete it through your kidneys. And you are very, very good at that, or most of us are very good at that, at two ends of the age spectrum. Okay, the very, very young don't have very good kidney function because their kidneys are still developing. As you get older, your kidney function is less good, and that's where you're beginning to potentially accumulate more aluminum because you can't excrete it. Okay, through most of your life, you get rid of the vast bulk of whatever you're going to eat; it's simply gone. When you inject aluminum, it goes into a different compartment of your body. It doesn't come into that same mechanism of excretion. So, and of course it can't, because that's the whole idea of aluminum adjuvants. Is aluminum adjuvants are meant to stick around and allow that antigen to be presented over and over and over and over again persistently. Otherwise, you wouldn't put an adjuvant in the first place. It can't be inert, because if it were inert, it couldn't do the things it does. It can't be excreted, because again, it couldn't provide that prolonged exposure of the antigen to your immune system. It simply goes against all logic to say that the aluminum is there and it can't do anything. Because, of course, we know it does something, and that's why they put it in vaccines in the first place.
And keep in mind, aluminum is a neurotoxin, and you're putting it right into that baby's brain, and that's devastating. Now, we're going to hear something a little different. We're going to hear a very short minute-and-a-half piece about, remember, they're looking at all these beautiful mega mansions. We're talking about really expensive mansions. And a bunch of young people walking down the street, teenagers or college students, were asked, of these candidates, and they had pictures of all the Democrat and Republican candidates, could you match the candidate with the house? Here's what they had to say.
We're here right in front of the White House with our new guest named
Allison.
So Allison's going to be playing Candidate's Cribs with us, and you are going to try and guess which candidate has lived in which mansion. First up, we've got what I'm calling the Embassy Estate. Who do you guys think of these candidates has lived in the Embassy Estate?
Let's go with Marco Rubio.
Marco Rubio. I like the way you say Rubio. Say it again.
Rubio.
I'll go with Ben Carson.
Dr. Ben Carson has lived in the Embassy Estate. That's what we're going with. All right. Next up, the Countryside Castle. Who you got?
I'll go with Jeb Bush.
Jeb Bush, making bank. The Hampton Hideaway, a cool $11 million. So who do you think is able to afford that?
Mark Rubio.
Senator Marco Rubio from Florida.
Ben Carson.
Ben Carson. All right, he's making that neurosurgeon money. Last, but certainly not least, is the beachside bungalow.
Donald Trump.
No doubt that you think Donald's the one that can afford that?
Yep, yes.
For the beachside bungalow, who do we think lives in the beachside bungalow?
I'm going to say Marco.
What if I told you that all four of these were Hillary Clinton?
What?
What? Really? Hold on, you're pulling my leg.
No way.
Are you serious?
Oh, wow. Are you serious?
Are they really? Damn, then she does have that kind of money.
Oh, yeah. And that's not all. That's just four mega mansions, $13 million, $12 million. Yep. Let's see if she brings that up on her campaign. Now, I want to play you a piece before we go to our guest of Nigel Farage. Now, he and I would share substantially different views on a lot of things, but there's no one, absolutely no one, who stands up and raises hell in the European Parliament like he does. And on this one, he got it right.
And now Mr. Farage for the FD Group.
Thank you. What we're seeing in this chamber this morning, and indeed across the whole of Europe, is an irreconcilable cultural difference between Greece and Germany, a split between the north and the south of Europe. Europe, the European project, is actually beginning to die. Nobody in this room will recognise that, but actually the peoples of Europe are saying we were never asked whether we wanted this. This has been foisted upon us. And we need to understand why EMU doesn't work. Those monsters, Kohl and Mitterrand, backed up by the clever but dangerous Delors, believed that if they put in place an economic and monetary union, then as night follows day, there would be political union, that there would be an acceptance of this project, that the north and south of Europe would converge, that we'd all start to love each other, that we'd all begin to feel a European identity, that we'd all begin to show allegiance to the flag and the anthem. Those of us, of course, that criticised this were told that we were extremists and we lacked vision. Well, one vision we didn't lack is we understood that the countries of Europe are different, and that if you try and force together different people or different economies without first seeking the consent of those people, it is unlikely to work. And the plan has failed. This isn't just Greece we're talking about today. The whole of the Mediterranean now finds itself in the wrong currency. And yet virtually nobody in the political arena has got the courage to stand up and say that. Indeed, I feel that the continent is now divided from north to south. There is a new Berlin Wall, and it's called the Euro. And the old enmities have been resumed. Just listen to the way that the German leader of the Christian Democrat group this morning attacked Mr. Tsipras. I think it was absolutely disgusting, but it shows the way north and south now feel about each other. Mr. Tsipras, your country should never have joined the Euro. I think you acknowledge that. But the big banks, the big businesses and big politics forced you in. Goldman Sachs, the German arms manufacturers, they were all very happy. And when the bailouts began, they weren't for the Greek people. Those bailouts were to bail out French, German and Italian banks. They haven't helped you at all. And these years of austerity, these years of high unemployment, of increasing poverty, none of it's worked. In fact, your debt-GDP ratio has gone from 100% at the start of the crisis to 180% right now. It would be madness, sir, to continue on this course. You have been very brave. You called that referendum when one of your predecessors tried to do the same. The bully boys of Brussels had him removed. They tried their best again. Mr. Juncker said you would have to leave the Euro and leave the European Union. Even Mr. Schulz, the president of the Parliament, who one would have thought might be neutral, said that if the Greeks voted no, their power supplies may even go down. There were threats and bullying, but the Greeks stood firm. But, sir, you cannot have your cake and eat it. They will give you no more, these people. They can't afford to. If they give you more, they'll have to give other Eurozone members more. So your moment has come. And frankly, if you've got the courage, you should lead the Greek people out of the Eurozone with your head held high. Get back your democracy. Get back control of your country. Give your people the leadership and the hope that they crave. Yes, it'll be tough for the first few months, but with a devalued currency and with friends of Greece all over the world, you will recover.
Okay, that's one perspective. I would agree with that, that they should leave the Eurozone, get their own currency, and in time, though they will have to go through this, they will rebuild the democracy, learn the lessons from the past. And I believe that what is really behind this is the fear that if they do this, then you're going to have Spain, your Portugal, Italy, France, Ireland, other countries doing the same. There's an enormous divide, and you see that when you're over there. I'm Gary Nall. Let us go now to our guest in Ottawa, Ontario. I mentioned earlier a little about his background. He is a professor, Professor Mahdi Darius Nazimiratozo. He is an award-winning author, scholar, geopolitical analyst, specializing on the Middle East and Central Asia. He is a research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal. He's a contributor to the Strategic Cultural Foundation in Moscow and the Voltaire Net, and is a member of the Sunday Committee on Geopolitica in Italy. And during the Arab Spring, Mahdi reported from North Africa, particularly in Libya during the NATO bombing. He was the one who provided those of us who cared about the truth there, the dispatches through global research and Flashpoint. More recently, his focus has been on the upheavals in Syria and Iraq and the role of the U.S. in the Middle East instability. He's the author of Globalization of NATO, which, by the way, has been held by many leaders as a tour de force on the expansion of NATO and its threat to peace and global security. Nice to have you with us today, Mahdi.
Thank you for having me on your program.
Mahdi, everywhere we're finding nations where the U.S. has intervened, turning more unstable and fragmented than prior to our militant actions. We've seen Gaddafi's Libya fall to a corrupt U.S.-backed regime, and the present Egyptian regime is more despotic than under Mubarak. Hard to imagine, but it's true. And Syria has yet to fall, but the nation is a basket case, as is Iraq. And the U.S. is supporting some of the worst Islamic elements in the Middle East to achieve its mission. In fact, I just saw a report that proves that one of the reasons that they targeted the embassy for destruction in Libya is because there was gun running, there was weapons running that was going to the more extreme elements to be taken then into Syria. So we were supporting elements of terrorist organizations, and that wouldn't go well with the American people if we said, yeah, we're running guns for terrorists. And there'd be, for the older people, they'd remember, you know, guns and drugs. We getting the drugs, the Contras getting the guns. So I'd like to begin with Libya, but this was a country that we are forgetting became the hallmark for a developed nation in Africa before the U.S.-led coup to topple Gaddafi. It had the highest per capita income, some of the most progressive social programs in the world for its citizens. Women had almost equal rights for men in all areas of society, including education. And although Gaddafi ruled, as all of them do, as a strong hand, he aggressively suppressed radical Islamic fundamentalist elements that would disrupt Libyan society and growth. And by all standards, rather than being perceived as a pariah and an enemy of Washington's consensus, the U.S. and its allies could have played their cards far more constructively and humanely to have had him as an ally rather than demonize him as a threat. So please begin by explaining why the U.S. and NATO were determined to remove Gaddafi by a regime change and share, and Hillary Clinton was an architect of that and bragged about it, and share a little bit about the difference between Gaddafi's Libya and Libya today, and how does this new destabilization and a destroyed Libya now serve the U.S. and NATO's larger interests?
I'm more than happy to discuss Libya then in the Gaddafi years and Libya now in the post-Gaddafi years, 2011 afterwards, after the NATO intervention led by the United States. Most of the work was done by the Pentagon, even though the U.S. said it was leading from behind. It pushed the British, the French, basically the European members of NATO to publicly be the face of the war when it was actually calling the shots. But I also want to remind listeners, the audience out there, that it's important to know that these extremists, these deviant forces, they didn't appear out of a vacuum. There's been a historical record on about this. Let's not forget Afghanistan and the Cold War. The United States deliberately using proxies and allies like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan cultivated these type of forces during the Cold War, originally against the Soviet Union, but after the Cold Soviet Union collapsed, against any state that was not falling into line with Washington's diktats. So what you would call so-called rogue nations like Libya, Syria, Iraq, Al-Qaeda didn't come out of thin air. So there's a history of support for these groups, not just from weapons, even and training, even ideologically. Let's not forget the Taliban's books that said kill Christians and Jews were printed in the United States and sent to Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, or to the madrasas in Pakistan where the Taliban were cultivated by the Pakistani secret services, the ISI. So there's a history of using these Al-Qaeda-like groups as foot soldiers. And throughout this whole ordeal, talking about Libya and beyond, in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, the United States try to sanitize, the U.S. government, that is, of course, not the American people, the U.S. government try to sanitize the image of Al-Qaeda. It tried to put away Osama bin Laden, the boogeyman. It was denying that even Al-Qaeda was on the ground originally, but international media sources that weren't controlled by the U.S. or its allies, such as Britain and France, were reporting that these were definitely extremists that were doing the fighting. These were not Democrats that wanted voting, that wanted equality between different groups, whether they were ideological, faith, gender. These were hardcore extremists. They were cutting heads from the very start, and this was being censored. It was blatantly being censored. So Libya during the Gaddafi years, as you pointed out, Muammar Gaddafi was one of the biggest threats to him was these type of groups, which also included a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood in Libya. The most well-known is the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which the British supported, and so did the United States. Muammar Gaddafi was opposed to these groups because they wanted to oust them from power. And these are the groups that have now taken control of the country. And Libya today is not one country. It's several countries. It's more or less been balkanized. There's different governments in different parts of the country. So Cyrenaica to the east on the Egyptian border, where Benghazi is located, is basically more or less autonomous and independent. Misurata, where there was a military council, that's on the Gulf of Sirte, that's more or less autonomous as well. Tripoli, the government in Tripoli, which the U.S. and European Union decided to put in, more or less has no control outside a few streets and its offices. You know, it has no, there's gangs running different parts of greater Tripoli and Tripolitania, which is that region in the north towards Tunisia. The western mountains are basically autonomously run by militias. Fezzan to the south, on the border with Chad and Algeria, is more or less autonomous. Tribes are autonomous. The country's been divided. And actually, I'd like to point out that the head of U.S. intelligence in 2011, he told in Congress during a hearing, he said more or less that what's going to happen is in the post-Gaddafi years, Libya is going to revert to its pre-1969 divisions. So they were very well aware that the country was going to implode. And in fact, where I'd like to put these two factors that I brought up, support for these extremists and the implosion of the country, well, the United States in 1982, the U.S. National Security Council, under the Reagan administration, put together a plan that was revised by NATO in 2011. This plan was called Operation Flower. The secret plans were referred to as Flower, and it was divided into two parts. One part was called Tulip, and the other part was Rose. They're the subcomponents of the secret plan for taking over Libya. Tulip was the code name for the CIA covert operations designed to overthrow Gaddafi by supporting anti-Gaddafi exile groups and militants into the country. So, and the other part was to involve neighboring countries or regional countries in attacking, and that was Rose. That was the military aspect, which was a surprise attack. And it was actually Defense Minister Robert Gates, who approved those plans, reviewed them while he, in 1982. He wasn't defense minister at the time, but it was him who reviewed them as the deputy director of intelligence at the time. And he endorsed Rose, the military subcomponent of FLAUR. Later on, when he becomes defense minister in 2011, those plans were revamped and used and executed by the U.S. government. So you have the aspect of supporting the militants, the aspect of a military attack, a formal military attack, and it was used. And that also falls into line with an older objective by the United States, by Britain, and by France, as well as Italy, to divide Libya into three. See, after World War II, there was a very concerted effort by the United States and those three European countries to divide Libya into separate trusteeships, you might call them, more or less colonies, protectorates. And that failed because of the Soviet Union and several, and as well as Egypt under Gamal Abdel Nasser. But those plans were always there, put on the shelf. So it was integrated in 2011 with the Tulip and Rose. And the Libya before this period, the Libya under Muammar Gaddafi, was a country where there was health care, where foreigners would come to work and stay and live. I mean, it's one of the few places where I've seen Southeast Asians feel very comfortable in the Arab world. Now, if you travel to places like the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, you'll see people coming from the Philippines to work, and the treatment is absolutely horrible. I mean, there's cases in Libya of bad treatment too, but many of these workers actually ended up starting their own businesses and staying. Libya was a country with pan-African objectives. They wanted to unite Africa, develop Africa, and to stop it from being dependent on outside powers. And I was told by a Libyan official during a meeting there very clearly that countries like the United States, Britain, France, they didn't like that because the Libyans wanted to industrialize their neighbors and themselves. They were pushing for a Pan-African bank, Pan-African telecommunication networks.
And Nazim, they were also wanting to trade in gold, not in the dollars, the reserve currency, as did...
They had a totally different... they wanted to redraw the financial architecture of Africa.
One thing
and this
I'm
was not acceptable to countries like the United States.
Did it surprise you at all that some within the liberal and the democratic community, including Pacifica's own Democracy Now, which is a completely privatized entity, but that they were pro regime change in this? Did that surprise you at how the left actually supported the administration's policies on Libya?
No, I wasn't surprised because I remember Yugoslavia the aftermath of what happened in Yugoslavia. It was a repeat of that. You know, there was supporting, there was letters that were signed by prominent figures in the so-called progressive community, supporting and endorsing a war. I don't know how you can endorse a war. It's not progressive at all.
They're not real. They're not real progressives. They're corporate Democrats disguised as progressives.
Now, so-called. That's why I said so-called.
Yeah. One final question for you, because we're running out of time. The other nation you've researched extensively is Syria. Now, granted that Assad and his brothers and his father are dictators, it was primarily a secular government and didn't permit radical religious elements into its administration. And most of it is desert. Only 10% of the landmass can support agriculture, and hence they've been victims of severe drought. In fact, between 2006 and 2011, they had a drought that was compared to the U.S. Dust Bowl in the 1930s. 800,000 farmers lost their livelihood, and crop failures rose to 75%. Overall, it's a poor country. Even most of its own oil production goes for domestic consumption rather than export. Nevertheless, Assad's rule did make considerable progress compared to the conditions of Syria before, and to many of their neighbors, including Saudi Arabia. And it has a relatively high literacy rate of around 8 out of every 10 Syrians compared to Iran and Saudi Arabia. And this was before the U.S. military posturing in support of the radical Islamist organizations to topple the Syrian government. And when Bush included Syria as a member of the Axis of Evil, it was on account of Syria's openness to multi-ethnic and religious diversity with many minority groups. And once again, you got the left coming in, at least the corporate-sponsored left, those that get their money from the Ford Foundation, George Soros, condemning them. And now, everyone in the American media condemns Syria, and they all want to see regime change. And give us your perspective on this, please.
Well, as you mentioned, Syria's accessible resources are few compared to countries like Libya or Saudi Arabia, despite the fact that the resources were much less, relatively less. This country, Syria, the Syrian Arab Republic, is much more advanced than either one of these, many of these Arab countries. It's because, number one, the state belonged to all Syrians, regardless of their faith. They could be Alawites, they could be different types of Shiites, they could be Sunni Muslims, they could be Orthodox Christians, they could be Roman Catholic Christians, they could be Druze, they could be Jewish. It was a state for all Syrians. So that's their viewpoint. The government is not an Alawite government. That typecast is very wrong. The cabinet ministers, if you look at the formation of the government, if you look at the military's ranks, if you look at the civil sector, it reflects the demographics of the country. So, yes, the president's Alawite, but the prime minister's not an Alawite. The speaker of parliament's a Sunni Muslim. The defense minister was a Christian. I mean, this was obviously used to justify the attack on this country with very little accessible resources. Of course, I'd like to point out there's a lot of untapped natural gas off the Syrian and Lebanese coasts, and that's something that falls into this equation. President Bashar al-Assad, I met with people who used to be his opponents, and I actually was in Syria about a year ago. And during the presidential elections they had, I was there. Many people who were his opponents, and they said they would normally even be his opponents, started supporting him because of what was happening. They said, well, our options are very limited. Do you want us to support people who cut heads and eat hearts and are going to destroy the coexistence in this country and execute people because of their backgrounds or ideologies, or do we have to support a government that gives us security? So, I mean, a lot of people who opposed them, and that includes some prominent Arab activists that I met with, who actually Saudi Arabia was trying to bribe into changing their positions. One of them was actually on the Arab League observer mission, and we met in Geneva when we were speaking at the United Nations Human Rights Council on the sidelines of a meeting there. And he was on the Arab League observation mission, and he said that he was an opponent of Assad. And this, of course, changed it. So a lot of people, Syrians and Arabs who oppose Bashar al-Assad, they understand that the option, what will take its place is something like Daesh. Daesh is the Arabic acronym for ISIS or ISIL.
Okay, we're going to continue our conversation on an upcoming program. Mahdi, we're out of time. My guest, Professor Mahdi Darius Nazim Rahazeh. That's Nazemroaza. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. As many times as we've loved and we've shared love. And